Good evening. Welcome and thank you for being here. My name is Doug Dibbert, and on behalf of the General Alumni Association, we thank you for being with us tonight. 36 years ago, a telegram conveyed to my mother the tragic news that her husband had been shot and killed in South Vietnam. That single bullet forever changed my life and the lives of my mother and my four younger brothers. A year later, I was a Carolina freshman, seeking answers, seeking understanding, and over the course of my years at Carolina, the war grew. And my search and the search of other Carolina students for understanding led repeatedly to members of our Carolina faculty. The tragic events of Tuesdays have forever changed the lives of each of us, perhaps in ways we cannot yet know. As a university community, we seek answers and understanding. Again, we turn to our Carolina family and our Carolina faculty. And we do so not as an academic exercise, but with deep compassion for all those who have lost loved ones, including some who are Carolina alumni, their families, friends, neighbors, and colleagues. Tonight, we come to be together, to learn from each other, and to share. To begin, we have asked the Reverend Stephen Stanley, a UNC chaplain with the Chapel of the Cross, to again, as he did at yesterday's midday program on Polk Place, share his concern about the importance of compassion and tolerance. Reverend Stanley will be followed by Farrell Guillory, Director of the Program on Southern Politics, Media, and Public Life, who will address media and political considerations and serve as our moderator for the evening. Reverend Stanley.
Good evening. On Tuesday afternoon, when I went to pick up my 17-year-old son, Brian, from high school, on the way home, he said to me, "Papa, what's going to happen now?" And I realized that that's not just the question of a teenager, but a universal question, not just a question that has been asked about this week's events, but throughout history. What's going to happen now? Because all of us try in one way or another to make sense of our experience, and that's what all of us are trying to do now. And those of us in the religious community don't have the answer to that question, but we know how important the question is. And I said to my son and to my students this week and to my congregation into the campus yesterday that we can draw some encouragement from knowing we are not alone in wrestling with both the horror and the hopes that we have for coming out of this. And Ray Linville asked me to share just a few words with you to set that context of human compassion and the search for meaning. If we think that we are the first or that this is unprecedented, we can go back very far to the Hebrew psalmist in Psalm 10, who wrote these words about the horror that that person experienced in their own time. And I quote, "They lurk in the public squares, and in the secret places they murder the innocent. They spy out the helpless. They lie in wait like a lion in a covert. They lie in wait to seize upon the lowly. They seize the lowly and drag them away in their net. The innocent are broken and humbled before them. The helpless fall before their power." Psalm 10, verses 8 through 10. These words have credibility because they are the words that touch our deepest humanity. And this drives us to the core of our deepest humanity. And people in our own time, like Archbishop Desmond Tutu, who have seen the horrors of war and prejudice and lack of compassion, have written words that are helpful to us now to at least articulate our pain. Bishop Tutu, writing in his book, No Future Without Forgiveness, penned a poem in the midst of the Truth and Reconciliation process in South Africa. His words are as follows. "The world is wept. Blood and pain seep into our listening, into our wounded souls. The sound of your sobbing is my own weeping. your wet handkerchief, my pillow, for a past so exhausted that it cannot rest, not yet. Speak, weep, and listen for us all, of people of the silent, hidden past. Let your stories scatter seeds into our lonely, frightened winds. Sow more until the softness of the land can soften, can dare to hope and smile and sing, until the ghosts can dance unshackled, until our lives can know your sorrows and be healed. There we touch the eternal hope of resolution and peace, which is not represented in one religious tradition, but in all religious traditions. And prayers for peace come together in a common prayer for humanity. Some of those that I quoted yesterday at the vigil are these, from St. Francis of the Christian faith: Lord, make us instruments of your peace. From the Kaddish of the Jewish faith: He who creates peace in his celestial heights, may he create peace for us and for all Israel. From the Quran of the Muslim faith: In the name of Allah, that we may know each other, not that we may despise each other. From the Native American community: O great spirit of our ancestors, give us the wisdom to teach our children to love, respect, and be kind to each other, so that they may grow with peace of mind. From the Hindu tradition: May the Vedic law propagate peace throughout all the world. And finally, for those who claim no particular faith tradition: May our tears be prayers. May our trembling hands and cold sweat be prayers as well. May our whole humanity and the earth be as prayer for us now. In that hope and joining with our ancestors and with generations to come, we offer a prayer of all humanity, that we not be divided in this time, but find new ways to be united in a common search for meaning and compassion. Thank you.
Good evening. On behalf of the panelists, I would like to say how much we genuinely are stunned and appreciative of all of you being here. I encountered Doug out on the out on Pope Place at noon at the gathering of students that was set up, and Doug said it was a he and I agreed that it was a pretty amazing gathering there, and he said he hadn't seen anything like it since Kent State, and there are enough of you in the audience old enough to remember Kent State, and it brought to mind that I was a graduate student at Columbia at the time, and we had a big debate on the day after the Kent State incident, and we had a big debate on whether to close the university or not. And the students voted, and because emotions were running so high and I didn't think we'd have much learning done the next day, I voted on the side to close. Well, the other side won, and I've lived to regret my vote, because I learned the next day when the faculty of Columbia on the spot turned around and did an amazing set of seminars about what was going on in the country, the war in Vietnam, and the role of universities. And anyway, it was in my experience the single most exhilarating day that I spent on a university campus, and I learned a hard lesson, and the lesson has stuck with me. I told my students this week that even though they weren't feeling like having class, that we were going to have class, because it was important, and we had two very interesting and lively discussions in class this week. And this has been a pretty impressive week at Carolina, and I want you to know that just as Columbia rose to the occasion 30 years ago, that your university has risen to the occasion this week and has been a tower of strength and of learning and of teaching. And we brought together, I say we, the Alumni Association, Ray and Doug, have brought together an impressive panel here. It's a big panel. We're going to ask them to stick to about 5 minutes each, so that then we can have time for questions and answers afterwards. So what I'm going to do is introduce them one at a time. They'll come up here and talk for a few minutes, and then I'll introduce the next. So please listen. Think of some challenging questions, and there will be time for a good exchange. I'd like to begin with Jim Smith, Dr. James F. Smith, who is a professor of finance at the Kenan Flagler Business School, who many of you know as an economic forecaster of renown and accuracy, often quoted in the press. And he and his wife were at the World Trade Center this week, and he's here to reflect on the experience that he's had this week. And so we're delighted that Jim is back safely in Chapel Hill. And so your first presenter is Dr. Jim Smith.
Thank you very much, Carl. I didn't have a lot of time to prepare anything, spending the last 2 days trying to figure out how to get out. First, how to survive, and then once that was assured, how to get out of Manhattan. For more, tune in the 10 or 11 o'clock news tonight. As you walked in, it looks like everybody's going to have the story. And my wife tells it much better. She's a Kent State PhD, by the way, so an interesting connection to those events. I'd really rather focus on what this means, where we're going, what all of us have to do, what our leadership from President Bush and other senior elected officials need to do to turn this tragedy into a triumph. There's a bunch of really evil people out there. We don't know who they are right now. And I hope we don't go off half-cocked guessing, who want to stop America in its tracks. The United States of America is a shining light of opportunity to everyone in the world. The irony of this whole thing is made very clear. My wife spent almost all day Monday at Ellis Island, tracking down her grandparents who came to this country a little over 100 years ago, seeking freedom and opportunity and the ability to make their own determination of the future. Evil people are trying to stomp that out, to destroy symbols of American power like the World Trade Center towers. Our hotel was in between the two towers, so we were pretty much at ground zero, but we got out and we're safe, and we're grateful for that. It won't work. September 11th, 2001, 911 is going to turn out to be the emergency call to resurrect the U.S. economy, get us back onto a phenomenal growth mode, and drag the rest of the world up as well. For those of you who don't follow the global economy, as of Monday, it was in terrible shape. Japan's been in a recession for 10 years. They can't figure out what to do. The country's bankrupt. And if they don't do something between now and the end of this month, they could cause a disaster around the world. They won't do it. They'll figure it out. But why not tell us today? Europe is not doing well at all. Canada's faltering. We've dragged Mexico down. Really, the only two countries performing well in the world are China and Australia, and they're way too small at this stage to pull up the rest of the world. What President Bush needs to do, and so far he's doing an admirable job, he's an adopted Texan. I'm a native Texan. Texans by nature are optimists. We don't say can we do it. We say, how are we going to get the job done? How are we going to move ahead? How are things going to get better? This quarter, which ends September 30, is going to decline at a seasonally adjusted annual rate, economist jargon, 3 to 5%. We've got the events of Tuesday. But the president makes it clear, we're going to go about our business. We're going to get out there. We're going to adopt the slogan. I know it sounds corny, but it's true. You know, when the going gets tough, the tough go shopping. Shopping is the American way of life. Shop till you drop and fall to the floor. Gather your strength and go shop some more. You laugh, but consumer spending is about 69% of our total economic output. We're a $10 trillion economy. We grew in excess of 4% in real terms in 97, 98, 99, and 2000. That's the best four-year run of any period since 1962 to 1966. From the middle of last year to the middle of this year, we've grown 1.5%. North Carolina has performed more poorly than any other state in the United States except Michigan over the last 12 months. That's why we have a budget problem. That's why we have a rising unemployment rate. As more people get shopping, as businesses replace the equipment that's been destroyed, find new places to set up business, as we build new office buildings, and not coincidentally, and I'll leave most of this to Jack Cassarda because he's our airport expert, but just think about how happy you're going to be the next time you pull up to Raleigh-Durham International Airport or any other airport anywhere in the United States, and somebody walks out and looks at you as you take something out of the car to check it, takes it, puts it through an x-ray machine, probably these new high-tech machines that figure out is there any C4 plastic or non-metal residue. Well, we have the technology. It's just a question of money. We got caught up in a stupid, idiotic, pointless argument in Washington, D.C. Are we going to spend any money from Social Security? There is no money in Social Security. Anybody knows that. Social Security payments are paid by current taxpayers who send the money to Washington. The Treasury borrows the money. They send checks to current recipients. Right now, we're running about $170 billion a year, more receipts than goes in. It's just a paper entry. It's meaningless. And you're not going to hear anybody in Washington talking about that. You're going to hear about security, safety, preserving the American way of life. None of us are going to complain. None of us are going to complain. Not a Democrat, not a Republican, not even Bernie Sanders from Vermont. Who's a socialist, for those of you who don't know. We're not going to complain. America, the United States of America, is going to be back better than ever before, stronger than ever before, safer than ever before, and I hope by not starting a war just to show that we're mighty. We can be mighty by having a velvet glove and not exercise. Because my wife will tell you, if you ask her, the most beautiful sight she's ever seen in her life was being back here in Chapel Hill. But before that was seeing an Air Force fighter plane circling Manhattan Island. Well, we were traversing, it felt like the entire island. It was only a 3.5-mile hike, but it was a long ways to get to the Marriott Marquis, which was still had rooms and was taking care of all the people from the World Trade Center. We have a crack armed forces. We have a wonderful country, a wonderful way of life, and no lunatic is going to destroy that. And I went over 2 minutes. I'm sorry.
Our next faculty member is Mark Krasinski, an assistant professor of political science. He teaches courses in international relations, including courses in conflict and national security. And Mark, we're delighted to be here.
Thanks. Stand.
You can stand if you'd like.
I'll stand for this so these few rows can see me at least briefly. I began today, like all of you, with a fairly heavy heart. I was teaching my national security course Tuesday morning when we learned of this incident. Is that better? Improved? Okay, so I was teaching my national security course Tuesday morning when this all began, and I don't feel like I did a very good job of being tall. Leader for Carolina. I was in shock and spent the class period wondering if my brother would be okay because he worked across the street from the World Trade Center, and he is, and wondering how I'm going to explain this to my son who turned 3 weeks yesterday. So I have lots of emotions that I'm going to do my level best to hide from you this evening. because I am a mathematical political scientist. And if there's anything that I can bring to this evening and help you to understand these events, it's to bring a logical perspective, a political perspective on the events that took place and the possible events that may take place in our near future and in the long term. So I'm going to discuss options about retribution, revenge, and justice, which I'm sure are weighing heavily on your minds right now. But I'm also going to try and steer you towards issues of deterrence and compellence, issues of how we would extend our dialogue with these terrorists to include host nations. And those of you who have been watching closely or listening closely to events you've started to hear some language from the White House about how these host nations, the states, the countries that allow these terrorists to foster and propagate, are being included now in some of the policy options that are being considered by the White House. And I'm going to discuss my new thoughts on how we might best use this opportunity for deterrence in the medium term, medium run, to try and prevent future issues, future attacks such as this one, and take some of the faceless horror away and put faces on it. And finally, I'm going to offer very unpopular advice about long-term solutions, about how we would go about fixing this problem, removing the motivation for terrorist attacks, which will prove to be one of the most difficult things. As, like I said, I'm deeply patriotic and won't share a bit of that with you. And if I fail in that, then I apologize. I'm going to keep my time short and save it for questions. Thank you.
Our next faculty member is Corey Dauber. She's an assistant professor of communication studies, and her research focuses on argument strategies that underlie the debate in the United States over defense and military policy. She is a member of the Defense Advisory Committee on Women in the Services, which is an advisory committee to the Secretary of Defense. And Corey, we're delighted you're here.
I just want to show you a couple of things, because I think right now it is important to think about what we're feeling, because it has an impact on the way we understand, the way people talk to us about what's happening, and the way we respond to the words that are being used. Raise your hand if you spent part of Tuesday on the phone tracking down someone you love in New York or Washington. Look around the room. We live hundreds of miles away. Raise your hand if your first response when you heard what had happened was to go to a TV set. Raise your hand if you spent way more hours watching TV over the last 48 than you normally do. Even if you're embarrassed, I want you to be honest about the next question. Raise your hand if you're kind of in a retaliatory frame of mind. Emotions are running high. Here's another question. Now, I'll be honest. Raise your hand if you've been crying over the last couple of days. And different things are setting all of us off, but we're all responding in the same way. I think it's important to talk about that, because that has implications for what the president is saying, what senior leadership is saying, and the way we are responding to that. And I'm the rhetoric guy, so I'll be answering those questions, so I thought I would just make that visual statement, but I think it's important to keep in mind that we are all having the same responses, in part because we are all having many of the same experiences, and I'll pass the rest of my time back to the crowd.
Thank you. Michael Hunt is a professor of history who writes and teaches in the general field of international history. And he's here to talk about the foreign policy implications.
Thanks.
Well, my colleagues have been very brief, so that maybe allow me a little more time to say a bit. I think we all feel some grief, a considerable grief, over the loss of innocent life on September 11th, and that naturally, as we've already made very clear, we all understand, has led to outrage, and in turn, I think the understandable call for striking back. And I think talk of vengeance at this point may be therapeutic, but I think, as an historian at least, and I'm using my discipline to try to come to terms with this disaster, this tragedy that struck the country, that before we do that, the country needs, before we launch off on a crusade in the Middle East, I think we need to do a little bit of reflection. And let me suggest two propositions, very broad propositions, that I think might prompt some hard second thoughts. First, the terrorist attack that we've just witnessed, I don't think should be dismissed as a psychotic act by crazed fanatics or dismissed simply as that. I think we might more usefully see what's happened as an extreme expression of a broad-based regional reaction against deep U.S. entanglement in the Middle East, spanning over half a century. Now, there are two points to this, and sort of dealing with it chronologically as an historian. Many of you who are older remember the Cold War, and the Cold War carried this into many regions, including the Middle East. And there was a campaign to promote stable, secular, pro-Western regimes that would shore up the anti-communist containment line and to assure the flow of oil to the U.S. and to its allies during the Cold War. And I think you could say that Washington acted on a vision of the Middle East that was tied politically and economically to the West. And there were critics of that vision even early in the Cold War, critics of that vision, from Arab nationalists to economic nationalists to Marxists to neutralists. They didn't like the vision. The U.S. policymakers soldiered on. They thought that what they were doing was the right thing, and in the process made two critical decisions with legacies still playing out today. First, to support Israel, and second, to overthrow a neutralist, economic nationalist regime in Iran. That was in 1953, and replace it with a regime that was tightly tied to U.S. interests, the regime of Mohammad Reza Shah Pahlavi. To take the somewhat more recent period, to kind of bring the story down from this formative period in the early Cold War down to the more recent period, and really the last 30 years, the Middle East has emerged for the United States as one of the chief zone of crisis and conflict, and in effect really displaced East Asia, Korea, China, Vietnam as the major zone of danger and conflict war for the United States. Over the last three decades, we've remained an active player in the political, military, economic, and cultural life. We've had a wide-ranging impact on the region. We've been on both the receiving and giving end of suspicion, misunderstanding, retaliation, and violence. The undercurrents of opposition to the United States became stronger during this period, and they increasingly found expression in terms of Islamic values and resentment over U.S. support for Israel. Troubles began, I can go through a long list here that many of you may be familiar, but I think it's useful to put this in context. There's a chain of events. This is not just simply September 11th is not an eruption. You could go back to the oil embargo of 73, the overthrow of an unpopular U.S.-backed government in Iran, government of the Shah I just mentioned a minute ago, and the taking of American hostages, certainly an earlier traumatic event associated with the Middle East. Support for Iraq and its long and bloody war with Iran in the 1980s, bombing of Libya, the dispatch of Marines to Beirut, the Gulf War, residual American presence in the Middle East. Since the Gulf War, continued containment of Iran, isolation of Iraq, and the ongoing protection of Israel. So we're not simply a bystander to the Middle East. We've played a very important role in the region. And we don't need to decide now whether the position the U.S. took has taken over this time, whether those positions were good or bad. We do have to recognize that while most Americans may not be aware of this pattern of U.S. entanglement, it is widely understood and resented in the Middle East. Because of this interference, it has been easy for critics in the region to denounce the United States as an obstacle to economic development, to social justice, to cultural integrity and continuity, even to democracy. It's also been easy to label as neo-colonial the order promoted by Washington, in effect linking the U.S. policy to earlier British and French efforts, imperial enterprise in the region. We're a country of well-intentioned and generous people,
And therefore, it's difficult for us to imagine how our role might, at least among some, generate a hate that would inspire such a deadly and indiscriminate attack. But there is no alternative for us, I think, except to try to engage in some kind of historical imagination and cultural imagination to see the situation from another perspective other than our own, if we are to avoid lashing back blindly. My second proposition, and this I can make more briefly, is that Americans have been highly ambivalent about the use of military power over the last half century. And I think we may talk of going to war. The president has done that. Secretary of State Powell has done it. And these may be politically expedient and emotionally gratifying terms to use. But such talk flies in the face, I think, of a well-established popular allergy in this country to protracted or open-ended commitments that result in the heavy loss of American life, as in Korea or in Vietnam, as in Beirut or in Somalia, to take more recent examples. These calls, I think ironically, may in fact, in the final analysis, violate the very rules for combat commitment formulated by Powell's generation of military leaders who went through Vietnam and came out and said, we've got to do it a different way. The classic statement by Secretary of Defense Caspar Weinberger in 1984 included the following provisions before we use our troops in combat. Act only in defense of not vital national interests, devise clear political and military objectives, commit to win, use the appropriate size and type of force, be sure of the support of the American people in Congress, and seek first non-military solutions to the problem. Powell himself, while serving as chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, said almost a decade ago, the use of force should be restricted to occasions where it can do some good and where the good will outweigh the loss of lives and the other costs that will surely ensue. Wars kill people. Are we clear that we have satisfied these prudential conditions for applying the massive power available to us? Do we have clear objectives? Do they reflect definitions of the national interest that will win sustained, not just current, but sustained popular and congressional support? Do we have the kinds and size of force needed? Have we exhausted non-military solutions? Perhaps above all, as moral agents, can we apply our military power in a way that does not multiply human suffering?
Michael. My friend and colleague Jack Casorda is the director of the Kenan Institute on Private Enterprise, and he teaches management and information technology, and he travels from here to Thailand often, extending the influence of our university in the Pacific Rim. Jim already told you that he has a special understanding and knowledge of travel and logistics, and there's been much made of the symbols of the World Trade Center and the Pentagon as the targets here. I'm haunted by the symbol of the airplane, of how much it stands for our freedom and how much it's integral to our economy. So I'm delighted that Jack is here, who can help us understand this dimension of what has happened to our country.
Thank you, Farrell. In commenting on the implications primarily for the economy, our own lives, as we saw here with respect to the demise of Midway Airlines yesterday, I don't want to dismiss the sadness and compassion we all feel for those whose loved ones and friends have been affected by this tragic series of events. But let me broaden the perspective a little bit, because it really does come down to impacting our lives, the lives of those at all levels of the social economic ladder, and the ultimate competitiveness and prosperity of this nation and other nations. Aviation was born in North Carolina, December 17, 1903, with the Wright brothers' flight at Kitty Hawk. The 21st century will be the aviation century, just as the 18th century was driven primarily by seaborne commerce and moving, the 19th century by railroads, the 20th century by highways, automobiles, and trucks. From the most macro perspective, many people don't realize that 42% of the value of world trade goes by air today. The United States is involved in a reticulated supply chain that comes down to affect you as a consumer, affects people producing parts and components in Thailand or Brazil or Mexico. It affects the way the stock exchange operates in New York. If you listen to business educators like Peter Drucker, or economists such as Lester Thoreau, or futurists such as Alvin Toffler, they're all saying the same thing, that logistics will determine the future of America's competitiveness. And increasingly, those logistics are tied to aviation. And what has happened is that we really have moved into what many people may call the fast century. We're moving into a period of fast forward, not only in terms of the travel by business people and faculty. There's been no real replacement of movement by advances in information technology, but in particular the way in which goods move around the country and around the world. A laptop computer produced right here at home at the Research Triangle Park is really not manufactured, it's assembled. The integrated circuits come from Japan. The disk drives come from Singapore. The glass screen comes from Mexico. The electrical system comes from Thailand. The keyboard comes from Taiwan. Mostly by air, they're plugged together. The pharmaceutical industry that is, and biotechnology that is so critical to this region's economy and to the country's economy, almost all of that product goes by air. We are finding that everything from digitized automobile parts to fresh cut flowers, seafood, agricultural products are increasingly moving by air. And why is that the case? Not only because we have determined and found that freshness is value, that delivery is value, but the fundamental drivers and priorities that shape today's industry are increasingly based on speed and agility. Price and quality are necessary, but the firms that are really competing and doing best today are those that have incorporated speed and agility into supply chains. And it's also interesting what we have learned in business school is that firms, at least those in the production sector, and Jim Smith knows this probably better than I do, no longer compete. The unit is not the firm. The unit is the network. The unit is the system. The unit is the supply chain. So when Dell Computer leapfrogged over Compaq Computer as the number one producer of laptops and PCs, it wasn't Dell competing against Compaq. It was Dell's global supply chain competing against Compaq's global supply chain, with much of that production being done around Penang, Malaysia, its parts and components being then shipped to the Dallas-Fort Worth area, where it was assembled and then delivered to the customer. So the point is that speed and agility have become critical, and it affects our daily lives. When you order a book from Amazon.com, how many just simply ask for 2 to 3 week delivery? No, you want 2 to 3 days delivery. E-commerce, despite the death of the dot-coms, e-commerce is increasingly growing in importance. And 70% of the products that are moved, whether it's business to business or business to consumer, go by express. So in this country alone, we find that when FedEx is shut down, when UPS is shut down, when the express service countries are shut down, it has a ripple effect through all of our lives. But it also has an effect, and I will wrap up with here, on what is increasingly a part of our own daily practices, whether it is traveling to California for a vacation or the Caribbean islands or to Europe. Our lives are forever going to be changed as a result of the events last Tuesday. Speed and agility is going to take a step backwards because of security. You're going to wait in line longer. You're going to find that the whole process of going door to door takes much more time. Business and industry is going to be affected because, as I mentioned, we're in an era of the survival of the fastest. Our products are not going to move as fast. There's going to be much more security check in the cargo holds and in the products that are shipped on our freighter aircraft. All of this is going to have an impact on our businesses, on you as personal travelers, and in general on our daily lives, including what is served at home and dinner, which you purchase in the grocery stores. It's often flown in with fresh lobster from Maine or jackfruit from Southeast Asia. It's amazing what is happening. And it is going to affect all of our lives in terms of the basic feelings that we all have when we go onto an aircraft. I think aviation will be viewed differently by everyone today because aviation was recently used as a weapon.
Thank you, Jack. Sarah Shields is an assistant professor of history whose teaching specialties include the Middle East and Palestine and Islamic civilization. And she's here to give us some perspective on the historical context and the people of the region.
Historians ask two questions. We want to know the causes, and we want to know the consequences. Tonight, Michael Hunt started talking about the causes, and I'd be glad to talk some more about that. But I want to talk to you about consequences. Usually we don't talk about consequences for 10 or 20 or 100 years after an event, but I'm kind of worried about these consequences because so far the things threatened as consequences seem to me to show a significant lack of imagination. I'm worried about the long term, and I'm worried about the short term, the direct and the indirect consequences, because I'm a historian. What we know from American contact with the Middle East is that violence leads to violence, that the notion of revenge doesn't end the cycle of violence. For example, Professor Reagan, in responding to a number of attacks, one against American servicemen in Berlin, bombed Tripoli in 1986. 2 years later, Libyans bombed an airplane leaving over Lockerbie, Scotland, in retaliation. Over and over, we see American service people and American innocents being killed in retaliation to an American retaliatory strike. We have here a horrific event. Retaliation is unlikely to be the final event in a cycle. I'm worried about bombing innocents, even if this were the last word. I'm worried about the consequences of what we're hearing the president calling for. In 1998, in the summer, two American embassies were attacked. In response, the Clinton administration bombed sites in Afghanistan and a pharmaceutical factory in the Sudan. The administration claimed that that factory was manufacturing chemical weapons. Hundreds of people, we think, died in that attack. The United States blocked an inquiry. But in addition, there were many, many hundreds of children's deaths that occurred because the plant could no longer make antibiotics, which are very hard to come by in the Sudan. The plant owner has taken the United States to court over the incident. The Clinton administration was convinced we had what we're hearing now. We had lots of evidence pointing to Osama bin Laden and to this factory. They've been able to produce no evidence in court convincing anyone that there had any reason to bomb the plant. It seems to me that one of our jobs as Americans, let alone as historians, is to try to figure out why the things happen that happen in the world, in our country. In order to do that, we need evidence. That's what we do. We seek evidence. That's what journalists do. That's what historians do. We can only seek evidence if we define the problem. I asked my students this afternoon to make me a list of all the ways they'd heard the people who perpetrated this atrocity described. They were evil. They were sick. They were irrational. They were mindless. They were evil. They were brutal and they were cruel. There's no doubt about that. But when we call them mindless and their act an act of mindless terrorism, we are no longer required to try to understand what caused it. Without knowing what caused it, we can't respond to it in any way to avoid it happening again. And we can't respond to it in any kind of just way. When you try to take people to task, to hold people responsible for their behavior, you first have to know who you're holding responsible and what you're holding them responsible for. Any court of law includes motivation. And we in America need to think about motivation. As long as we call them mindless terrorists, we assume they had no motivation. And we can't even begin to consider how to deal with the continuing threat caused by angry people willing to murder. We are furious, and we want revenge. And we need to step back and say that the people who are terrorizing us were furious, and they wanted revenge, and what they've done is killed innocent people. We don't want to do the same. That puts us at the same level as the people who flew their airplanes into the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. Here's the third thing. The first is, I feel like I'm in class here. The first point is that violence leads to violence. It's not effective. If we bomb another country, we get nowhere strategically. Second, we risk bombing innocent people, and we as Americans can't allow ourselves knowingly to do that. The third is a consequence at home. What we're hearing on the news is very uninformed commentary on who might have done this. The assumption from the first minutes, almost, was Osama bin Laden or people that the media calls Muslims. There's no distinction in our press between people in Afghanistan and Arabs. There aren't Arabs in Afghanistan, or there are very few Arabs in Afghanistan. If we bomb Kabul, we're unlikely to be killing Arabs, if that's what we wanted to. There are Arabs that aren't Muslims, lots of them. And they live all over the Middle East in many countries that we're allied with. But the saber rattling about people who are Muslim has resulted in violence at home. There are reports of people attacking Muslims, threatening mosques, threatening children in schools. We have reports on various listservs now coming in pretty quickly. We had a threat here in town at the vigil last night, screaming death to Muslims, kill the Arabs. Once we start getting into the mode of revenge and retaliation, we have to worry about the consequences that we unleash at home as people who are angry feel that they have a right to take it out on whoever they think is the appropriate victim. It's not part of Islamic values to kill. Every Muslim that I've talked with, and most Muslim organizations in the United States and around the world, have deplored this act, have condemned this act, have pointed to the fact that Muslims don't behave like this. And that's what I want to leave you with. I hope you'll ask me questions too. This act, if it was perpetrated by Muslims, is no more Islamic than Timothy McVeigh's bombing of the Oklahoma City building. The Murray Building. We never tried to attack all Christians because Timothy McVeigh bombed that building. And it never occurred to us to bomb Kansas for harboring a terrorist.
Sandra Van Sant is a counselor and a consultant, and she's a faculty member at the Principal's Executive Program, which is a wonderful program of trying to improve our public schools using the resources of the university to improve our public schools through enhancing the leadership capacity of the principals in public education. She's here to talk about concerns and issues related to grief issues, and has some thoughts for us on that element.
Thank you. I also want to talk as a member of the Carolina family. I'm an alum, having done my graduate work here. So what I'd like to talk about tonight is personal. In a way, it's simple, but it affects all of our lives in the Carolina family here in Chapel Hill, in the larger community, and I believe as a nation. Friends, we're grieving, all of us, in the midst of all of these political and financial realities, and we've all said that one way or another tonight. We've also said a lot of reasons for why we're grieving, and I'm thinking Carolina family now. We're grieving because we know and love people who have died or been injured or unaccounted for, or because we don't know them, but that has still happened. We're grieving because the familiar structures on which we hang our plans and our hopes and our dreams have turned out to be more fragile than we believed. We may be grieving because we are an Arab or a Muslim, and we believe now that maybe our friends don't trust us in the same way that they did. Or maybe our hosts don't, who have offered us hospitality and a place to study, to work, to raise our children. Some of us may be grieving because we're survivors. We expected to be on one of those four planes, and simply life circumstances kept us from being there as a passenger or crew member, and I understand there are people in this community for whom that's true. Some of us are grieving because we believe God has let us down, and our faith is shaken. In some very real ways, and we've all said it, life as we know it has ended. And we all face new beginnings. We all have adjustments to make. And it's interesting, every model of change that I'm aware of, whether it's a corporate model or whether it's a personal model, involves a period of transition that we go through as we leave something we've known and before we face the future and establish a new beginning. And all of these involve a period of grief. Grieving's normal, natural, and healing. And we get in trouble with it if we try to stop it or if we confuse feelings with acting out our feelings. We've learned this week that our nation and its structures are both strong and vulnerable. And I believe that's true of us as individuals. I think it takes strength for us to allow ourselves to be vulnerable enough to experience grief. I am concerned about two possible extreme reactions in this grief, which actually interfere, I think, with the grieving process. One of them is to minimize the impact of these events on both our society collectively and on us individually. I mean, we're kind of a let's pick us up by our bootstraps kind of people and go on. Second one is our inappropriately handling anger. Anger is a normal emotion of loss and grief. And I think this anger is likely to surface for all of us much more as we get into this adjustment period, as those lines form, as costs go up. From my experience, the whole process of grief can take different forms. Some people follow something of kind of a linear path through grief and going through different stages. Others of us tend to bounce around through different aspects of this, but I just want to mention some of the common reactions to remind us. The shock and disbelief. Tuesday's been described over and over again as a surreal day. People describe themselves as sleepwalking, as not being able to focus, as going around kind of in remote control, not able to divert our eyes. Look at the hands that went up. How many of us just watch those scenes over and over again on TV of those airplanes flying into the World Trade Center? Now, fortunately, this whole reaction of shock and disbelief does tend to dissipate, but it also precedes other reactions. Helplessness. Finding something concrete to do is helpful, but there's only so much blood that can be gathered and processed, only so many people who can directly offer some time and energy and expertise to people and causes that are immediately in the scene. I think there are things we can do with that, though. I think that we can volunteer our time and energy and professional expertise for those causes and for those people that we believe in. And I think what this will do is to help us accommodate our own need to help, but also help our nation reclaim the values that have been violated. I think we can also just be willing to be listeners. Listen to each other. Let people talk out their feelings. We don't have to do anything about it. Just support that they're valid. Become good listeners. Anger, which we've talked about, that leads us to want to have revenge. I think anger is a secondary response. That underneath it are much more primary responses dealing with hurt and fear. And I think that the way we deal with this is often just to have that very knee-jerk reaction of a flight-fight response. And I think we can avoid getting into trouble in this stage because I think it's where we get into most trouble, either as a nation or individually, is to get into those primary emotions of hurt and fear. Become aware of that just basically biological response of fight and flight. Maybe become aware individually of which of those two we're more likely to respond with. And then once we know those inclinations, get on into letting ourselves experience that hurt and that fear so that we can take the next step, important step of separating our actions from our feelings. It's important to acknowledge those feelings, and it's important to recognize we have a choice on whether we act on them or not. And then there's one important option that we often forget, and that is the option of talking. We can talk these things out, particularly if we can get underneath the anger. We don't accomplish very much when we stay at anger. It's done its job when it's gotten our attention and let us know there are issues and problems and that there's fear and hurt. But we can problem solve from a more rational place when we allow ourselves to get to that primary level. I think at this point it's important to talk to our children, to encourage them to talk, to listen to them, to see where their feelings are and what their thoughts are. What are their fears, or are there any, that they are expressing? At the same time, be realistic to them, with them. Let them know that there are bad things that happen in the world, and reassure them that mainly we don't have the bad things happening. And it's okay to be sad, a little scared, when these things do. The what if questions. Such questions of what if they'd only whatever, not gotten on the plane, not gone to work that day, done a better job of security, reacted more quickly when four planes were off course. And again, these are natural kinds of questions. And in my experience, we tend to bounce back and forth between these kinds of questions and anger, and that's normal. I think we need to be able to accept these questions. Sadness. Crying is a healthy mechanism for working through sadness. I think giving ourselves permission to cry is a gift to ourselves and to others for whom we model its acceptability. Just being with our sadness, rather than squelching it, is a way of letting it go. The good news in this is that grieving is a generally forward-moving process. We do eventually recoup the energy that's put into the grief work process. We don't call it work for nothing. And that will then give us the energy that gets us into this transition where we can explore what our mission is and what our omission is. What we will do and what we won't do, collectively, as a nation, as a Carolina family, and as individuals. A couple of tips, or maybe a tip, and that's that I think we can expect grieving to be at times messy, painful, frustrating, and hopeful. Especially as we begin to problem solve and restructure our lives as people, as a people and as individuals, and even with our sadness. The good news is that this process is often transformative. That's what I've been working with my clients and with other, particularly, with all clients, but particularly in the last couple of days with college students and college-age young people that I've talked with. What they've helped me understand in a way that I don't think I had, that this is really a loss of innocence in a way, and security, in a way that it affected my generation with the Kennedy assassinations.
Thank you. At the beginning, Doug told you that I was going to speak on the journalism and the political implications, but I'm going to use the prerogative of the chair to, as they say in Congress, to yield back my time to the audience. You have heard eight stimulating, yeasty, fascinating presentations, and I think it's your turn now to raise questions. I'm not ruling journalism and politics out of the discussion. I'm just saying I'm yielding back my time. And I think the process is going to be there are microphones around. I will repeat the question or summarize the question and direct it folks on the panel. We may have responses from more than one. It's important that you speak clearly, tell us your name, ask a succinct question. Okay.
Hey, I'd like to, first of all, thank you guys for your words and helping us understand this a bit more. I'd like to perhaps propose that that the space. Hello? That maybe you could share the words you've shared with us here today in this space, because they're big words in a bigger space where more people can hear you. That I think it's really important, because what we get a lot from the media is not as informative. That's all. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Rob Reese. I guess, much like you guys, I agree that I would, being a Christian, I choose peace over war. But also, being a student of international affairs, a former student here at Carolina, also a former student of Dr. Shields, I have to ask a question that credibility of threat says that if somebody attacks us, if somebody attacks us 50 times and we retaliate 49, the one time that we don't retaliate is the one people remember. Now, given that, would military action be the right action? And if we don't retaliate, how will other countries perceive us? How will our allies and our foes perceive us? Will we be seen as more of an easy target? Will that make us open to more attack?
Okay, that's a challenging question. Professor Shields, would you like to?
Yeah. Oh, sure. That's it right on to me. The new kid on the block.
It's up one right off the bat. It's compelling to do it. Okay, I think you're right. There's a big question here of,
is this on?
Yeah. Just close.
Okay, just close. I think there's a big question here of how the United States is going to have to respond to a threat, to an attack that was made in terms of what we would call a repeated event, right? In terms of trying to prevent future attacks from taking place. And clearly there's a fear that a lack of a proper retaliation, a proper reaction, a severe enough reaction from some perspectives, would lead to a signal to the rest of the world that this is okay, right? That this is behavior that is rewarded quite grandiosely. And I think there's a big fear out there that this will lead to further attacks of terrorism, right? Obviously, the success, the remarkable, astounding success of this attack has not just reverberated in the present, but it has led to extreme concerns about future attacks, copycat attacks, or similar attacks. That's, of course, why we don't have commercial airline travel, and that's, of course, why we have all these changes in our liberties that we fear may be coming. Right? And so, but having said that, I would like to say that I find the retaliation aspect of what I think we are going to engage in over the next five months to a year is fundamentally unsatisfying if it doesn't fulfill the goal of deterrence, right? If it doesn't fulfill the goal of preventing future terrorist attacks. So this is sort of an opportunity. Whether or not what we should do is not a question that I'm qualified to answer. I think the signals that we've been receiving from the president and the White House are pretty clear that some sort of military retaliation will take place. There are definitely other options. There are economic options, sanctions. Of course, we've been engaged in sanctions with Iraq for quite some time, and their success has been highly debated, but few are claiming that it has been a successful action. But economic sanctions, blockades, things like that, ways to try and choke off the opportunity for terrorist propagation are prevalent. But the military action seems to be coming. And my hope is that We can expand the action to be multilateral, to be international in a very broad sense, and legal, such that we set a precedent for deterrence in future years.
Professor Dauber has a thought.
Point that I made before, I think, is an important one. We have to remember that we're leading with our emotions so that we remember that a response is appropriate. But I think it's also important to remember that not every military response is by definition an irrational military response or an inappropriate military response. And I just have to say that every time I hear someone say that we should not do as we were done to, I think that's true. And I hope we don't end up killing innocent civilians. But I feel fairly secure in this prediction. I don't think we will do as we were done to, because I'm fairly sure that we have never used civilian airliners to crash into skyscrapers.
One more comment here.
I feel like the question was sort of directed at me, so can't hear it?
Yeah, we're okay.
So I feel like I need to answer it. Got a dead microphone. Here, this is. I feel like the question was sort of directed at me, and so I feel like I should answer it. I'm at a disadvantage here because I'm not a theorist. I'm a historian, and so I can't tell you, according to models, what will happen if we don't respond with an immediate military attack. What I can tell you is, if we look at the past in the Middle East, we can predict a response to our response. And that response isn't that people will say, wow, the United States is so powerful. It'll be, we're really, really angry that they're bombing cities or they're bombing civilians. So it may be that in theory, responding with a military retaliation should be a deterrent. Historians look at it and say, that's not the way it happens. Americans don't tend to hijack civilian airliners, but we have shot civilian airliners out of the skies. And I think it's important to recognize that when we do things like that, there are responses. The models and the past don't seem to come together here, which is one of the reasons that it's good to have political scientists and historians on the same panel.
Let's go to the next question.
Hi, my name is Niels Brubaker, and my question is, if I would agree that a sort of a general military attack would probably not be appropriate, but it seems I would like to ask you, is there some kind of a response aimed at bringing to justice those who are responsible for perpetrating this act? What would you propose, what do you suggest might be an appropriate legal and humane, if you will, in terms of not hurting, you know, innocent people that we could try? And I'm thinking, too, in the long term, I'm not saying we have to do, I'm afraid the American public tends to be rather impatient. I'm thinking, is there something we can do over the next months or years even that where we could track down the people responsible for this and bring them to justice?
Crisis, the rhetoric professors, the phone lines have been buzzing. And everybody's been going back and forth on this question as to whether it was appropriate that the president has been using the language of war. That's been the question of the day for all the rhetoric people. And my question to all the folks who've been posing that question to me, my question back to them was, well, if that isn't the narrative frame that you would choose, if you would have had him, if you don't want him saying we're at war, what is the alternative you would propose? And what they said back to me was, oh, criminal justice is the alternative narrative. You have him say a crime has been perpetrated against the United States, and that way he has wiggle room. That way he doesn't squeeze himself into a box where the only alternative is military. And I thought about that answer, and I guess I'm satisfied with the rhetorical choice that he made because I don't because I don't mind that he has not left him wiggle room in terms of the fact that military response is coming. Because deterrence is fundamentally a rhetorical proposition. It is about the credibility that you have. It is about, it is a military response that has a persuasive effect, if you will. In other words, it's not just about the damage that you do militarily, it is about the statement that that damage proclaims. And my concern is that this is a situation where the magnitude is such that, I mean, I'm not in a position, we're beyond my level of expertise if you ask me what is the appropriate military response, but I think we are at a point where if all we do is put the guy in the dock, that we do not, I mean, it seems to me that the most fundamental statement about national security, the most fundamental piece of national security is kind of, you know, national security. And this was an attack on the United States homeland. This was the most fundamental questioning of our nation's security. I don't know how we can respond only by bringing someone to trial. It seems to me that no nation, not just a great nation, but no nation can survive not taking some action in response.
It's a tough question because I think you have to separate military action from deterrence, right? Anytime you actually see military action, you have seen a failure of deterrence. And it's too late to deter the attack. So the only way that you can, you have to separate what we're going to do in terms of retribution and try and establish a method of deterrence that focuses more on the host nations that are housing these terrorists. You know, try and choke off the economic supply lines and the logistical supply lines that reduce the opportunity for future terrorism. And at the same time, send a signal with this current military action that deterrence is all about the promise of a future military action. Right, and so that's what the events that are going to take place in the short term sort of set that up. What follows in terms of successful deterrence will have to be more related to carrots and sticks and trying to get these host, in a sense, compel these host governments to join us in this fight against terrorism. Make it so that their own existence or at least their own prosperity is threatened by housing and propagating terrorism.
One more comment from Michael Hunt.
It seems to me we really need to go back to the question of evidence that Sarah Shields raised earlier. We first of all don't know exactly who's done this and which states or state or states have been involved. And I think therefore to ask will deterrence work really is not an abstract proposition. If you look at it historically, it's a matter of getting into the mind of the people, the state authorities or whatever, the groups that are involved. And that takes, to go back to a point I made, I think a considerable leap of imagination. We don't all think about these problems exactly the same way, and if we try to project onto others our own logic, I can point to almost an infinite number of examples where we've tried to do this. We've assumed that other people think just like us, and therefore, if we did this, we would respond in this way, and it doesn't work. And the other point here is that because once you strike back, trying to establish a deterrent effect, you're setting off a chain reaction, and you don't know the consequences of that reaction. And it's a very tricky business. And again, if you look at crises, they almost never unfold the way that policymakers expect them, and often they take very unpleasant surprises. And so I think this point, to just conclude very briefly, very quickly, I think the point about considering options, other options, we may be in the dark for some time, and even once we get the light on this and have more evidence, there may be other options. Regime building has been a major feature of our world over the last three or four decades. We've developed regimes on human rights, economic regimes, a whole variety of regimes that countries talking together have put together, and the treatment of war criminals in the Balkans is a perfectly good and new example of this drive. And this might in fact be one very interesting way to try to further expand those sets of regimes and promote cooperation among countries that seem almost unanimously to condemn and are fearful of this sort of behavior that we've experienced.
There's a question there next to Ray. Questioner, I'm sorry.
First of all, it makes me really sad to see on the media and to hear.
Tell us who you are.
My name is Barbara Trent.
Thank you.
It makes me real sad to see that our sorrow ends at the border, that over a million people have died from the sanctions in Iraq, 5,000, 6,000 every month under the age of six, and our sorrow and our grief is not so great. What happened in New York is horrendous. It's, it's death. It's killing. I'm completely opposed to it, but I'm continually shocked that we have these arbitrary borders, and if it happens within this line, then it matters, and if it happens over that line, it doesn't. Like all the people dying in sub-Sahara Africa of AIDS who can't get medicines from GlaxoSmithKline and people who won't make prices available so they don't die. The numbers worth looking at in New York, the devastation in New York is, this is small compared to what's happening around the world.
So give us your question.
If we're going to bring them to justice, then we have to be just, and we have to nurture justice, neither of which we do. I'd be glad to hear a comment on that. And the last thing I'd like to say is that if deterrence is the issue, I don't understand, and I would like for someone to explain to me how a military response, how killing and evil and blowing parts of people's body off their bones in any way creates a world safer for all of us in which to live, where people don't want to do this because we can never stop them. We can never stop anybody from doing something if they're willing to die to do it. We have to make friends in this world. Mike, you're the only person and the woman next to you that I heard say that. I'd be curious if other people really believe that we can stop people from fighting oppression or whatever it is they're all fighting, because we don't even know who did it.
Okay, thank you. Let's go to the question back there.
My name is Bruce Forrest. I'd like to again thank the panelists, and I can appreciate the dialogue we've been hearing this evening, and I also like to thank everybody else for coming, because I really needed to be here this evening. I needed to hear some other viewpoints and to see what Chapel Hillings was thinking, because I've been under a lot of stress because of this week. I have a comment. It's a foregone conclusion that America is going to strike at what we perceive to be the enemy. And to that end, I think we as Americans should be behind the government 100%. However, I heard a comment on NPR News just before getting out of my car coming here, and one of the commentators quoted, I believe, a quote from Douglas MacArthur, who said that it was important not only to win the war, but to win the peace. And to that end, to me, from my perspective, that means at some point in time, we're going to have to address the issues that the Arab world has. We're going to have to respect their concerns about their plight. You know, it reminds me of inner city America. You know, we have young black men who feel hopeless. And when we see them tearing up and shooting, and we that have so-called made it, the middle class, the upper class, we often wonder in bewilderment what's going on. 25 years ago, I was one of those young ghetto men. I'm a businessman now. I have interests. I didn't wear this blue, red, and white for nothing here tonight. I respect the police today, the military. I voted for the last 10 years for Jesse Helms, not because of his social views, because of his military stance and his moral views.
With all respect, I've got a lot of questions out here. Give us your question.
My question is this. Bill Bennett the other night on TV said that we were going to stamp out this evil around the world. Can somebody, preferably the political science gentleman, could you please comment on just where that evil is?
Right. That's a good political science question.
The softballs just keep coming. Thank you.
I think I'm going to extract a question from those last two comments to suggest that deterrence is an extremely difficult problem, and how do we really get it done right? And I think the answers are very difficult. I think we're dealing with three phases here towards resolving this solution permanently. The first is an unavoidable act of retaliation, which many of you will support and many of you don't support. I'm not qualified to tell you whether that is morally right or wrong. It's going to happen, and everybody up here that has said there will be unintended consequences, they are exactly correct, and it's going to be messy. The second stage, if we can get there, will be to try and deter future attacks by removing the opportunity for terrorism, removing the opportunity for its prospering. And that's why my thoughts have been leaning towards incorporating these host governments and giving them incentives to battle terrorism on their own, and giving them threats of punishment, deterrent threats of punishment, to if they fail to do so. In the long run, though, I think you've tapped into something very important. In order to solve this problem in the long run, we have to remove the willingness for terrorism. And it's an incredibly difficult thing to do. It's incredibly difficult to think about doing that now, because it is going to involve bringing these disenfranchised groups back to the bargaining table and ceding some of our influence in the Middle East and really backing off. And that's maybe something we may not be willing to do.
Yeah. Yeah, all right. There's a question there. There's a young woman in a brown dress back there that's been trying to get your attention. If you could go back that way, we can get some other questions in. Yes, there's a question right here in the middle.
I'm Bob Jones, 81 years old, and a World War II veteran. Now, I'm waiting for somebody to tell me that we should have loved Hitler into submission. But there is good in the world, and there's evil in the world. And I have yet to have anybody to tell me how that the good can overcome the evil without some force.
Okay. There's a question over here. No, wait a second. There's.
I have Ira Friedman. I have a statement and a question and three questions. The first.
Now let's edit yourself. Give us the best of the three.
Well, the three all go together. They go together. But first, I don't think that this country attacked a commercial airline and used it to attack innocent civilians, at least on purpose, at least for the commercial airline shot down. But my three questions all go together. One is, this country refused to bomb the concentration camps in World War II for fear that we might harm innocent people. Do you think 6 million people would have been killed had we bombed those concentration camps where the Germans were holding the Jews? Do you think that if we didn't retaliate against the Japanese and the Nazi Germany in World War II for fear that we might harm innocent people, do you think that the Allied powers would have won? And lastly, do you think that Israel would still be in existence today if they didn't respond each and every time to the terrorism that they suffer day after day?
Okay, that's great. We're going to go to the next, back there. Let's go to the next one back there. Okay, they want to answer. We'll.
Go ahead.
Okay.
No, you lead off. I'll be glad to follow.
What's that? Okay.
What was that?
I can't hear you, actually.
Okay.
Okay, we're going to answer.
None of the microphones work.
It's okay.
Does the microphone work? Okay. I think that the questions about World War II are different historical questions about which there are big debates right now, and I'm looking directly at my colleague who does World War II, so I wish he could answer those. Here's my response. What we're talking about is bombing Afghanistan. I want you to know that the people in Afghanistan did not choose the government that harbors the person we think, without evidence, is responsible for this bombing. Now, it may be that in a bigger sense, we need to talk about things like deterrent, and I can't help with that. And I can't even help with the argument about World War II. What I can tell you is that the people in Kabul, the people throughout Afghanistan, have had a dreadful half century. They have been invaded and fought against the Soviets. They then had to deal with the creation of an absolutely oppressive government that's making life dreadful for the population. The people of Afghanistan did not choose the Taliban, and they did not choose a continuing civil war, and they did not choose to harbor bin Laden. And there's no way they can get rid of them. The Taliban and bin Laden are creations of the CIA. They're not creations. Do we need to go through the history here? They were created and, or at least supported and trained by the CIA as part of the anti-Soviet Cold War struggle against the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan. So now what we have is a population that has been oppressed and has been dealing with a famine that's lasted for a few years now. These are not people who can overthrow their government. Their government is oppressing them and is in complete control. Are we going to bomb them? They didn't make these choices.
On the question of U.S. support for Israel, you raised I think, an interesting point. And I think my response here really would go no further than this. The United States, as I suggested, has been deeply involved in the region, and any response we make to the events of September 11th need to take into account the fact that we have been deeply involved. We need to understand the region for which we have claimed an important voice over the last 50 years. And so all I'm really calling for here is that we have more historical perspective. I've heard, and maybe Farrell would like to say something about this, and I've heard virtually nothing in the commentary over the last several days that would suggest that the background to this goes beyond anything but a few crazed individuals. And I think if we want to be a world power, we're virtually unchallenged in almost every respect one can imagine at the moment. We're at the height of our preeminence, and yet we don't even begin to understand the impact we have on other regions, other people's lives. And I think it's a terrible gap. And it's a deficiency that I think is showing up particularly acutely at this moment. Do you want to say something about the media?
The question that Michael raises is about the media, and I think the first thing that you have to say is that in the crush of events, the focus has been on the event and. One of the real challenges for journalism is to shift from just reporting, how many pounds of dust and the travail on the streets of New York. Not that that shouldn't be reported, but it's going to be very critical for journalism to begin. Putting other layers on the story. There's a very interesting story, for instance, in the New York Times today by their correspondent in Kabul. Now, how many other newspapers are going to pick that up? I don't know. Hopefully, once the Times, as the kind of the pace setter, that the television networks and others will begin to do it too. The danger, of course, and the thing that I worry about is that we will slip not into explanatory journalism, but back into Yale television that has so dominated us over the last couple of years. And I think that's the critical demarcation line that we haven't quite gotten to. If the cable networks and others go back into reporting attitude and opinion unhinged from fact, then we're in trouble. I don't think they've done that yet, but we're approaching a critical moment, whether we will go deeper into explanatory journalism, which is important, or whether we'll veer off back into what I call Yale television. Yeah.
I'm finding it really disturbing that we have a very polarized group here, and feeling sad if my comments have encouraged that polarization. I don't think that that's what the GAA intended, and it's certainly not what we intend to do in our classes. And I think that perhaps I'll work to tone down my rhetoric, and it might be helpful if others did the same.
Yeah, we've got about 5 minutes to go, so let's get a couple of quick questions in. Back to, yes, yes, ma'am.
Thank you, sir. I'm honored to speak. My name is Joy Cagle. I'm a citizen of the planet. Merciful heaven around us. I thank you, sir, for your comments about our internal unrest and hopelessness, urban black men in the streets, and making a parallel. I had not thought of that. I promised I would not speak unless I was moved to speak. The question I have is based on the idea that I have that all things are related. And so I would ask, the summit on racism that occurred, was it last week? I just know an iota of this. I'd like to know what Dr. Shields' position is or thoughts are on the summit on racism and the U.S. withdrawal from that. And my understanding that the Sudanese people are being sold into slavery now, currently. I look at the panel, and the other comment I had was on the media, and I'm losing that thought, but it's the movie The Three Kings speaks is by Spike Jonze. I know this is a little fragmented, forgive me, but yeah. This is so important. That we realize that that America paints a picture that it is best to be white and middle class, and the movie The Three Kings speaks of that. Another.
Why don't we just take your question that you have on the table?
Why don't you do that? Thank you.
Does anybody want to speak to the implications of the conference in Durban as it relates to this? That's my understanding of the question.
I don't know that we can speak to the implications of Durban or anything else until we know who attacked us. It's impossible to discuss specific causes in that kind of an airtight way.
Yeah. Why don't you right there stand up? No, you. The guy just looked around. Stand up and give us a question.
Farrell, this will be the last question.
Okay. Just speak aloud. We can hear you.
Okay. Thank you very much for choosing me. Actually, I'm an international graduate student, and to me, I just feel there's something wrong with U.S. foreign policy, because as a foreigner's eyes, I just see that today's U.S. government have played some unilateral roles in the world. You are superpowers, that's correct, but I think somebody just don't realize that we are living in one world. We have to cooperate with each other. We cannot live alone and without anybody else's help. And my question is to Mrs. Dauber. Just now you cited that the innocent people killed in other countries are by the military weapons, not like by the hijacked commercial jets. But I think the point here is innocent people are killed. It's no difference there. Either they are killed by the F-15s or by the Boeing 1767. Do you agree with me?
No, I absolutely, positively do not agree with you. In the strongest possible terms, I disagree with you. It is always a tragedy when civilians are killed in military action. And I don't know a military person in uniform that does not agree with you as well.
I think that we try as hard as we can to avoid the deaths of innocent civilians. We do not always succeed. I understand that. War is an ugly business. The use of military power is an ugly business. I don't know what an appropriate military response is. I am not an expert in that area. I think we all pray that when it comes, it will kill as few people as possible, and it will be as limited as is possible. But I absolutely, positively refuse to acknowledge that there is not a distinction between the use of military power and military instruments of power and the use of our own citizens against their fellow citizens. They're being turned into a weapon against their will. That is something that is beyond the pale, and I will defend that argument down to the bottom line.
Jack has a comment.
I actually have an observation, Farrell, and that is that strongly held positions, forcefully presented, stimulate thought and debate, and that's what the Academy is all about. And that's what tonight was all about. Thank you very much.
Would you join me in thanking my colleagues here on the panel for our stimulating discussion? Doug. Hold on. Wait
Steve,
a second.
Please don't
this
leave.
This is not over.
Yeah, please don't
this
leave.
This is not over.
Please do not leave. I thank Farrell for his work as the moderator. I thank, most importantly, the panelists and the audience, because without you, there would not have been a discussion. There would not have been questions. For those who were concerned earlier that we did not have a larger capacity, please know that this evening has been taped. It will be available this weekend on our website, and we encourage you to go there. Now, to conclude the evening, yesterday, for those of you who were present, the program on Polk Place concluded with the Lorelei, and again, the Lorelei are going to conclude this evening's program, and we thank you for coming.
I am sitting here wanting memories to teach me to see the beauty in the world through my own eyes. I am sitting here wanting memories to teach me to see the beauty in the world through my own eyes. You used to rock me in the cradle of your arms. You said you'd hold me till the pains of life were gone. You said you'd comfort me in times like these, and now I need you, now I need you. And you are gone. Zoom, zoom, zoom. I am sitting here wanting memories to teach me to see the beauty in the world through my own eyes. Since you've gone and left me, there's been so little beauty, but I know I saw it clearly through your eyes. Now the world outside is such a cold and bitter place. Here inside I have few things that will console. And when I try to hear your voice above the storms of life, then I remember. memories to teach me to see the beauty in the world through my own eyes. I think all the things that made me feel so wonderful when I was young. I think all the things that made me laugh, made me dance, made me sing. I think all the things that made me grow into a being full of pride. I think on these things, for they are true. I am sitting here wanting memories to teach me to see the beauty in the world through my own eyes. I thought that you were gone, but now I know you're with me. You are the voice that whispers all I need to hear. I know a please, a thank you, and a smile will take me far. I know that I am you, and you are me, and we are one. I know that who I am is numbered in each grain of sand. I know